Thank you. Welcome to Concurrent Session 6B. This session is the future of healthcare and the impact on insurance. Now, before we commence, I'd like to recognise the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay our respect to their elders past and present. Today, we welcome Dr. Sean Chun and Al Merton. My name is Chow. Alan joined Deloitte as a partner in Sydney in February 2016 and has almost 40 years of experience across the breadth of financial services in consulting and corporate roles. He's a qualified actuary who has always used his technical and financial expertise in the insurance industry to advise or lead businesses to improve their performance. His sector experience includes life insurance, wealth management, including superannuation and pensions, health insurance, and general insurance. Alan has lived and worked in Australia, Asia, and Europe, and in consulting and executive leadership roles. Aside from general management roles, he has covered the full value chain from customer and distribution through to product and operations, as well as the appointed actuary, assurance, and other financial aspects of running businesses. Dr. Sean Chun. Dr. Sean Chun is a partner in Deloitte's healthcare and advisory team. Sean specializes in large-scale, multi-year, multi-initiative program and service evaluation, digital health, health innovation, strategic planning, benefits framework, and business cases. Sean has a particular interest in the use of innovative technology and data to facilitate better understanding and management of health and human services clients and system performance. Prior to entering consulting, Sean spent almost 5 years as a molecular virologist within the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the University of Melbourne. He leveraged his experience in directly supporting the Victorian COVID-19 response and strategic planning for the establishment of a statewide ecosystem for production of RNA therapeutics and vaccines. Sean's project work has included engagements across public, private, and not-for-profit clients in Australia and Canada. Please join me in welcoming both Al and Sean. Now, if you haven't downloaded the app, it's the QR code on your name tag. Please feel free to submit your questions throughout the presentation. But if not, then we can also use the speaker in the middle of the room for questions.
Thanks, everyone. Alan and I just wanted to spend a bit of time today talking a little bit about what we're seeing around the future of healthcare, where's it going, and then as far as, the focus of this conference, what impact and what influence is that going to have on insurers? So maybe to start off with, I mean, we spend a lot of money on healthcare in this country. We're the 15th. Ranked around OECD spending. It's about 10.5% of our GDP overall. About a third of Australians live with long-term illness. And our health activity, what we're seeing at the moment is about twice as, the growth in that is about twice as high as what we would expect from population growth and aging alone. So what we're seeing there is that people are living longer with ill health, and fundamentally our models are not sustainable. And so we see this globally, at the moment as well. Like, we're not the only country where this is an issue, but for sure, like, our system is unsustainable in the way we're delivering care at the moment. We have, if there's one stat that I sort of think about a lot is, some of our research shows that by 2050, almost half of our entire Australian workforce will be required to be delivering healthcare according to the current models that we've got at the moment to meet demand. That's clearly unsustainable. So about 45% for the accuracy. So what we need to do is look at, and we've been talking about this in healthcare for a long, long time, right? Like, for decades, around moving the focus of healthcare away from what we would consider, sick care. So our system at the moment is geared towards treating people when they're sick, not keeping them from being sick as much, right? So if you look at the top panel here, really looking at that pointy end of the spectrum where people are already sick, how do we treat them? It's very reactive, and typically also being delivered in some of the most expensive settings that you can find, right? Hospitals. So, you know, if you look at the triangle there, you know, the majority of our care at this, you know, in this current model is like happening at that pointy end. And so, you know, facilities-based care. And what we need to do in the future, and, you know, this slide you could have put up, and we've seen these slides, you know, I've actually gone back and looked at presentations from the 90s that had a similar pyramid to this, right? Which is to say we need to move further upstream. And we need to be providing more focus on, you know, well-being and preventative care. So what we're finding obviously as well is a big shift towards getting people treated outside of highly expensive facilities like hospitals into delivering more care in digital ways and also, you know, in the home, in the community, closer to where people live. And so if we look at the kind of models that we've got at the moment, if you look at this left-hand side, we go somewhere at the moment, right? You know, when we're sick, we go somewhere for treatment by and large. A little bit more, we're seeing that happen, you know, post-COVID in telehealth models. You know, it only took a pandemic to get those things going, right? Like we've been talking about telehealth and virtual care for a long time as well. And typically care is geared at the moment, like across the spectrum. You know, when we think about things like medications and those sorts of things, you know, they're all geared towards what is good for the average. Like we're moving now more towards personalized care and things that we have been talking about for a long time. To get there, you know, some of the roadblocks that we need to overcome are, you know, they're on the right-hand side, right? So ingrained mindsets, you know, we have a clinician workforce, we have structures, models that are all geared at the moment towards what I showed you on the previous slide at that top side, which is geared towards sick care, right? You get paid for, you know, treating someone that, you know, turns up to hospital or turns up to a GP or, you know, so by that stage, there's already, you know, an issue to be dealt with. It's very reactive. You know, I don't think I need to tell anyone in this room, like the systems are very siloed, right? Like the continuity of care between settings, hospital, primary care, community care is so fragmented at the moment, all the way through. So whether that be government, whether that be funding models, they're all separate. And so, you know, we're starting now to see a little bit of traction towards integrated models of care. But again, we've been talking about those for a long time. The other thing that, you know, needs to be worked through is infrastructure. So, you know, Alan and I, when we're talking about, you know, preparing for this conversation is, you know, where are hospitals at more broadly and how do they need to change to start to, you know, look at supporting new models of care? And then by extension, what does that mean again for insurers? Because at the moment, for example, models are quite focused on, you know, what happens within the four walls of a hospital and thinking about how do we come up with models that support digital means of providing care and then also, you know, some of the things that move further upstream into well-being and prevention. How do we start to support, you know, more of those types of models? So I think like this is just a diagram to kind of say like at the moment it's all fragmented. What we're hoping to get towards, you know, into the future is really what we see on the right hand side, you know, which is models that are much more integrated. And again, like I won't even use consumer centered because again, it's a term that we've been using for a long, long time. But fundamentally, coordinating, you know, players into new models. And what we're anticipating to see, and we're seeing this already in some jurisdictions globally, is a shifting of incumbent players to an additional set of new and emerging players that maybe haven't been part of a health ecosystem, you know, up until this point. So we sort of estimate that there's about 85% of health spend into 2040 will be in new models of care, new business models, new emergent players. Compared to what we're seeing now. You know, I think it might be a little bit slower than that. You know, those numbers are probably primarily based around what we're seeing in the growth and the speed that we're seeing that in places like America, although maybe that'll slow down now as well. But those are the things that we're sort of seeing that we should expect to trickle down here as well. So maybe, Alan, in terms of like how this, what this means for health insurance, other insurance, and how that translates, is really looking at, you know, mapping from those shifts in models of care, Through to different models of how we support that as well in terms of insurance.
There's a fascinating parallel. I don't know whether any of you picked it up, but Sean said, not healthcare but sick care. What industries do we work in? What do we call it? Life insurance? Health insurance? Well, isn't it really death insurance and it's actually sick insurance? That parallel is really, clearly some marketing people decided it was better to talk about health insurance and life insurance and healthcare. But that parallel goes right through to life insurers and health insurers, and some are already trying to do this. But it is the same thing, that as the healthcare provision moves as it has to Sean's point, towards preventing and risk mitigation, shouldn't we be moving faster and harder towards prevention and mitigation rather than paying when something goes wrong, helping people to prevent what's going wrong? And we've seen that a little bit in general insurance, but that's really the message that we're trying to give today, is how can insurers play into helping to move the system along in that direction? So there's a couple of things, and we're going to drop into some of these things. There are some interesting challenges. We make money out of premium. If you have healthier people, maybe we get less premium, we make less money. We shouldn't be scared of that. We should actually be positive about that quite clearly. And in fact, if we help people more, maybe more people will come to us than currently do. Personalised medicine, we'll definitely come to that, and the technology, you'll talk a bit about that as well. But the technology around people understanding themselves, every person who thinks about life insurance and underwriting as opposed to health insurance and community rating will be going, yeah, but if people know more about themselves than we can know, or they don't tell us what they know, or they don't share their data, won't we have a disadvantage? And where does our concept of pooling go? And then the big thing that we want to get to is the changing the thinking around insurers, because there's a funding issue. So our funding systems in healthcare, again, Sean can talk to that, aren't set up to encourage the prevention of ill health. And similarly, our insurance systems are not at the moment helping to fund prevention. We're still paying for treatment when you have a problem.
And I think maybe just to underscore that last point, that's not just in private health insurance. That's like, we see this in government, in funding models as well, right? Like the tension between state funding of, hospitals and acute care and Commonwealth funding of primary care, right? And so there's constant tension between how do we get better integration when our funding models are fundamentally separate. So I think actually it's a good segue into this. So this panel in the top left-hand corner is like the simplified version of funding flows in healthcare. Like, I don't know if anyone's seen that. There's a really classic graphic that shows all the funding flows in the Australian healthcare system, and it's like a spaghetti diagram, right? Like there's flows all over the place. But fundamentally, what this is sort of saying is that you've got kind of a government channel, and then you've got kind of a private channel. And so in private, you've got health insurers, you've got private, citizens contributing to healthcare. And then on the government side of things, you've obviously got, varying different flavors of how funding gets through from, taxation and others back into the system and pays for care. And I think in terms of paying providers, as I've said just now, you've got this different channels of paying for acute versus primary versus community. And I think the message there is that it's not an easy answer and it's not an easy switch, from one mode to another. And so there needs to be a lot of thinking that goes into how we do this.
And we're not going to pretend that we've got the silver bullet that will magically change this. What we're really talking about is helping to move mindsets along the way. But some examples of that. And there was a session. Did anyone go to the session yesterday on value-based care? That's a topic. Yep, I can see some nods. Really good presentation on the way you can use data to help. But that's an example. It's not a new concept. That's been around for a number of years. And again, a lot of this stuff that Sean's talked about is happening overseas. So it's not, don't read this that Australia would be leading the world. Actually, Australia's behind the world on a lot of these things. But it's thinking about how then can we influence and created advocacy so that the insurance mechanisms that we use are supporting. Could health insurers start to promote value-based care? And we'll pick up some examples where there's a bit of a move to that. Could life insurers, and I know there are life insurers who are trying to provide well-being and health incentives. You know, typically with the insurance in super, there's an offer of the wellness program for employers. So things like that are another way that the life insurers could do more and more. Workers' comp. This is not a single insurance sector problem to solve. It's across the sectors. And workers' comp is actually all about health and safety of workers. Again, should we be thinking about changing? So it's not just payment when something goes wrong. It's actually paying to help prevent the things from going wrong rather than government or employers doing it off their own bat. And the big thing, again, messages, some of you will be bored with me saying this and hearing it repeatedly from me in different sessions, is breaking down the silos. And I suspect if I asked, where do you work? A lot of you would say data science, because that's the latest trendy thing to answer as your number one work thing, but for actuaries. But, you know, most of you will say, I work in life insurance, or I work in health insurance, or I work in general insurance. And the reality is, to solve for some of this, we've got to work across the sectors, not within each sector separately. So we're going to take a bit of a look at the insurance value chain. We've painted it as a circle just because we thought that looked easier to fit on the slide. And I'm very conscious of the back. I sat at the back yesterday in a session. I couldn't read a thing. So hopefully you will be able to get some of this from the talk and the slides afterwards. But if you think about that picture of what we're providing, you know, we try and engage customers and give them a good experience. We provide products, and a lot of us at Deloitte talk about propositions, again, a bit of a consulting buzzword, but thinking less about the product being paying for a claim and more about the whole proposition. We price, we distribute and market, or we market and distribute. We do a lot of work on risk assessment and underwriting, and then claims management. And they're the sort of functions. There's a lot of other things, but they're the functions of insurers. And in some segments, you know, health insurance, you can't really risk assess, you can't underwrite, and you can price across portfolio. You can't price individually or by age. But some of the changes that, again, we've put some labels. We won't talk through all these examples, but there are absolutely examples in this market and other markets where people are trying to move along the chain. So customer engagement and experience, you know, if we've got personalised medicine and people know that they want to get fitter or get healthier, why can't we engage with them and support them on that? Is it giving them wearables? You know, it's not just about the gimmicks, but helping them to understand their health. Again, there was a great presentation yesterday on the Oura Ring and someone's experience. I'll see a few nods. I asked the question at the end, and this is an interesting challenge for us, Sean. You know, what did the medical professionals think of your data on the Oura Ring? And I think Amanda said they were pretty dismissive of the whole idea of using wearable data. So I think we've got to get over some of those things and start using the data that's available. But not just using the data for our purposes, but helping people with the data. We'll drop into some more of these in a moment. So I might move forward. Oh, did you want to talk about New South Wales Health briefly?
I was actually just going to pick up your point around on data and personally collected data. And I think, you know, if go back to, you know, the previous slides that I had, one of the things that we need to overcome is that cultural, you know, barrier, if you like, of, you know, clinicians accepting that information as part of what they need to assess as, you know, for your care. And I think we're getting a little bit better, like, on that side, but certainly it's not routine. And I think, you know, one of the things which will start to shift that is when clinicians can kind of see the benefit of that data that's being collected. And there's a mountain of data that's collected by, you know, individuals all the time that isn't being used as far as care. And I think until that is almost mandated to be absorbed and used to make, you know, better evidence-based, you know, decisions, we'll continue to have the conversation about it, yeah.
I've got a bunch of medical professionals in my family, and ever since the eHealth record was prompted in Australia, I've had arguments with them about it because they resist and complain, and I go, this is so important, it should be mandated. We must get data together, and it's beginning to happen. My prescriptions are now on my eHealth record finally, rather than having to dig through my text messages and find the script. So we're moving there, and that's a huge opportunity. Comes into underwriting, and, you know, I will talk about pooling and underwriting and precision. But there are plenty of examples internationally where maybe it's legally allowed a bit differently, or maybe they've just moved faster, where underwriting is being used by insurers, not just to risk assess, but to go further than that and to actually help people. One of, again, my big bugbears, which we should be able to change right now as life insurers, is people who've got well-managed diabetes and have had it for many, many years still will struggle to get life insurance. Why? The technology changes in helping somebody understand their blood sugar levels and their diabetes position has changed dramatically, yet we're still underwriting those people much the way we underwrote them 40 years ago. And why can't we create products that say, create underwriting processes that say, if you've got diabetes but you can demonstrate to us that it's well managed and you've got a program, of course we can insure you. And maybe we change the terms a little bit, but we can do better. Some other examples of this that for me come to mind. When we collect underwriting information, what happens to it? Any life insurers in the room a bit close to underwriting? What happens to the information we collect? Come on, don't be so shy. Okay. We make a decision. We accept in normal terms. We rate, we exclude, we increase the price. We tell the person that. Do we give them any of the information that we've received? Does anybody in the room know that their company gives them information? Pretty sure we don't. But isn't it in our interest to help them? Like, we've worked out there's a problem. Couldn't we do better and actually say, well, we found out something about you. There's something that you can do about that and we want to help you with it. And maybe we even go further and say it's not just underwriting a point of sale, but it's progressive underwriting that if, again, you manage your health well, will actually help you. My health's got actually a little bit better for good reason in the last little while. And if I think about the product I bought 30 years ago, I was rated badly. I've tempted to grab the actuary who's not in this room as far as I can see from the company that has my life insurance and say, you know, would you rate me better now and could I get a discounted premium? But it's just not something we do. We don't automatically think of things like that. So another example, Medibank's doing some really interesting stuff, Sean.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing this in a number of private health insurers now, right? Like, which is moving further upstream in the value chain and looking at how do they get, you know, further into actually delivery and designing new models of preventative care and primary care. And so, you know, MyHealth under Medibank has been looking at, we've been helping them redesign a model of primary care that moves things further upstream and starts to take the pressure off GPs and starts to look at how do you use different, you know, multidisciplinary care teams, you know, to enable you to get at proactive care and reduce some of the costs associated with even delivering care. And so, you know, there's sort of a win-win on both sides on that, you know, with that model. And it's a model that is, you know, certainly in line with the way that government is going with, you know, progressively moving kind of further upstream into prevention as well in terms of funding models.
So let's move on, because I said I'd have to cover risk pooling. You know, the life insurers in the room will go, oh my God, if we have personalized pricing, it's going to be a disaster and how will we manage it? Absolutely, there are questions for us that are not simple and we do have to deal with them. But extending just from the same themes, I think we've got to get over it. Someone might ask about genetic testing later, but people do know more, we can know more, and we can help people with those things. So if we're shifting from saying we're trying to select a homogeneous pool that all has a similar likelihood of problem and we can price it across the pool reasonably, to saying we can understand individual health better and we can help people with managing that, that changes the dynamic. And we do have to think about what we will price and what we won't price and what's controllable by the individual and what's not. And also who behaves well to improve their health and who chooses not to. But at the moment, we really haven't got those types of incentives in our life insurance system or our workers' comp system. Health insurance, we've got a whole different regulatory process around risk rating or not risk rating. But again, this is part of the theme that we're talking about, that if we want to see this move, some of the changes will need to happen in the way healthcare is funded, and a big part of healthcare funding is the health insurers. I won't, given the time, rather get some questions, so I won't go through too many of those examples. But I think we have to be conscious of where we've come from around pooling and how important that is, but start to think about whether there are sub-pools rather than the big pools that we look at and how we could work differently with our customers. So claims management is the other area that we wanted to pick up briefly today. Probably the biggest thing here is, and again, some of you have heard me railing about this problem before, there's a huge move towards this concept of the unified data, and maybe it'll be the e-health record, maybe it'll be the GP at the centre or your care provider at the centre not using the e-health record. Maybe it'll be that you trust your health insurer and they have the data and then the life insurer can work with the health insurer. But if we actually start to collate that data, what we can do very differently when somebody is making a claim is start to talk to them. We have the data and we can work across the different silos and we can think differently. There's, you know, the big problem in claims is actually the process of submitting a claim, and I'm talking more morbidity, illness, living benefit claims than death claims. They're problematical as well. But, you know, whether it's vulnerable customers or sick people trying to claim, that's a difficult thing to do. But think about the way we collect that information, forms or e-forms, lots of process, lots of tests. All that information that we ask for is typically already somewhere. Maybe some of it needs to be tested, but it doesn't just need to be tested by us. And if you think of somebody that's actually had an injury at work and they're going through, firstly, sick leave and putting in a medical certificate to the employer, and then they have a workers' comp claim and they go and get asked to provide all the forms and they go and get medical treatment, tick the box. Then they might have some private medical care and they have to go and do some more stuff. And then they might fall into a income protection claim or a trauma claim, and we again then ask them to prove everything and show us medical tests or get our own. That's a nightmare for somebody who's already struggling. There's got to be, if you think of that from the person point of view, our insurance system disconnects are creating a horrible experience. And yet we try and improve it in each little silo, but the prospect of having data that's coordinated and being able to appropriately grab and use it with permission, because permissions will be important, can help us change that whole structure of making claims experiences better and better for the customer and probably more effective for us as insurers. So, last slide, wrapping up. What should insurers be thinking about, Sean? And I'll come back to what should actuaries be thinking about.
And I think we've probably covered some of these as we've gone through. So, you know, as far as, you know, shifts around value-based care, you know, there really does need to be a shift in the way that, you know, models are designed, you know, to look at bundled payments, what's the sharing of benefit around, you know, those value-based care models, where does that manifest and amongst who in the ecosystem? You know, and that is absolutely moving away from those traditional fee-for-service, you know, more transactional-based models. And the complication there, I think, is, you know, a lot of the partnerships around that integrated care and coordination of that care provision makes it tricky to untangle those things. So, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to go around how do you fund properly around those. We know that tools like AI, I don't think you can have any presentation anywhere in any industry at the moment without talking about some form of AI. AI will help with you know, unlocking some of these issues that we've just been talking about. The other thing is what we're seeing more of in healthcare, although it's not mainstream, it's not ubiquitous yet, is actually the use of AI agents to replace some of the tasks. And so what does that mean for the cost of delivering care and those sorts of things, and how do we build those into, you know, models? And particularly if we think about the adoption of what we call PREMs and PROMs, right? So patient-reported experience measures and outcome measures, and how do they then drive value-based care? So those two things are really critical to getting a proper value-based care model. And then if we look at, you know, some of the broader, you know, advocacy that needs to go around, you know, some of these models as well, changing, you know, landscapes around regulation, And, you know, how do we control for some of those unintended consequences of moving funding models around and reimbursement models around? And then, you know, we have a huge reliance on, you know, how are our broader kind of solutions and tech providers going to start supporting some of these new models. So, you know, we've been having a look at, and certainly the government is looking to moving towards, you know, a much more complicated coding system in ICD 11, moving from 10, which is a magnitude larger in terms of complexity, which means we need tools to sort of manage all of that across the whole system. And making sure that, you know, we've got the policy settings right for all of that, I think, is, you know, really key.
So individuals, what can we do differently? I think what we're hoping to do is to get you thinking less, get you thinking more about the move from saying when something goes wrong, we pay and we try and do that well and we do it within our silo, to thinking about how can we help shift the system and how can what we pay for and how can how we deal with our policyholders start to shift the system towards helping people with their health, not as well as helping them when something goes wrong. I think that is ultimately what we should be doing. But there's absolutely a win-win if we get better health outcomes and we're still there to pay the claims when something does go wrong. So that's shifting to encouraging value-based care type models, thinking about the incentives, which may not be financial, they may be other incentives, but building our products and our propositions so we're engaging people around health and healthy activity more. Actuaries, you know, really good at data. We haven't quite owned the label data science. It's naturally, that's an actuary. But all the data that's beginning to come together, the analysis of it, if you work within one of these sectors, you know what's available in that sector. Open your eyes a little bit and look for what's available in other sectors. Hopefully some of you at this conference have been to sessions where you're being stretched a little bit to something else. There was a session on the NDIS yesterday in disability in Australia, and they talked about the database that's available for use. They're things that I don't think many life insurers are using, for example, to actually understand what's going on with disability. But we should be at the centre of those plays around data, and using that also then finally in advocacy, because we're the people that are trusted to put together evidence and data-based rationale for change. And whether that's some of us moving to work in Treasury or into the health departments to help push that, I know there are probably a few people here already doing that, or we're working for our companies who are helping industry bodies with saying, here's a change that we need to make. We are the people that can put together the rationales and the evidence for why we'll get better community outcomes if we start acting differently around the way we work with customers. So I guess final words of encouragement, move out of the traditional silos. Now, I'm not telling you all to change jobs today. Jazz would be really happy if you wanted to talk to him about that, wherever he is. But no, it's not necessarily move jobs. It's move mindsets. It's helped to shift the people around you. So we'll finish there and happy to take questions about, you can take the ones on Healthscope, Sean.
I might leave. I've got to catch a flight.
Thank you. Just a reminder, please submit your questions on the app. And if you haven't got the app, please stand in the middle of the room and speak into the microphone. First question. If we start from the assumption that everyone will ultimately still get sick and die, improving health will give people a better quality of life for longer, but do you think it will reduce ultimate lifetime healthcare costs or just defer the increase by pushing it out to an older average age? From Daniel London.
It's a great question. I think, look, it's and honestly, it's part of it is a big part of the conversation around sustainability of current healthcare, right? We also, you know, the sort of element of our current healthcare system that we don't like to talk a lot about is we also spend a lot of money on people at a late stage, end of life stage, that if you took a purely objective view, would not be a good use of money. But of course, when it comes to healthcare and you know, your loved ones, if it's, you know, spending an extra few months and or years, then I think most individuals and most individual families would see that as a good investment, but maybe not so much the health system, right? So I think it's a really valid challenge around how you accommodate for, you know, effectively shifting that cost further downstream, if you like, and how you accommodate for that in a broader model. And I think we are getting to a point where the sustainability of the system, even now, there are conversations around low-value care and stopping low-value care. And sometimes they're really tough decisions, right? And the model and the governance that needs to go around that, you know, still needs, you know, a fair bit of work.
Second question. I think I'll combine two questions together from Louise Devi. Do you think that the insurance industry limits innovation and preventative care advancement because people avoid seeking diagnoses, don't track health data, and refuse e-health for fear that it will lead to them not being insurable, paying more, or having a future claim denied? And a similar question from Ben Wu. People are still deterred in getting genetic testing because of life insurance loadings. How do you think we can shift the dialogue for the industry to handle this better?
Where do I start with this? I would love to see some real data on those problems, because certainly anecdotally and with the debate that happened around genetic testing, our industry failed to be ready for that debate. We didn't have data, and we couldn't even have the rational argument, so we lost the emotional argument without even having a rational discussion. I think people getting genetic tests is really good, so we can come to that separately. But I don't think there's actually a hell of a lot of data that actually supports the fact that people are really putting off testing. There are definitely going to be people in the know who will, or who may decide to do that. But is that a community problem? I'm not so sure. If it is, then we should be grabbing it wholeheartedly, and given for life insurers, we're facing down the path of not being able to use genetic testing. But my question would be, well, great. And somebody else made this comment at the Appointed Actuaries Forum. Can't see him. But okay, so if we cannot use genetic testing and the law says we cannot, and we tell customers that we cannot, why wouldn't we say to them, if you're prepared to have it and want to have a genetic test, we promise we will follow the law and not use it, but we'd really like to pay for it for you so that we can then help you with managing what information comes out of it. And so if you've got the theme of how can we help people with their health, we should be encouraging people to do things like this. And, you know, yes, it might mean we get some anti-selection. There's another data challenge for ourselves. If we think that's going to be a problem, then we should be starting to collect the data now to try and be in a position to have a discussion about why prices might rise because people are getting genetic tests and anti-selection. Very happy to have that discussion over lunch or coffee break or dinner or something like that. That's a much longer discussion.
Can I maybe add a perspective, Alan? Because I think there's a couple of things in it. So you had the question there around, are people not putting things into a digital record because of there's a concern of you know, it being used, you know, for underwriting decisions? I don't think that that's why people don't put things into a digital record. I think it's just too hard. Like, it's too hard in this country to do it, right? Like the conversation we had before around you could have a whole session on my health record, right? Like, I think people almost expect that their information is being used a lot more than what it actually is already. And I think we had a conversation at a digital health conference where I think actually until there's a challenge to the use of information that's already collected, like as a consumer, and from the perspective of that being used positively for my care, then we won't start to get overcome that. And maybe to put a finer point on it, like if something in my record should be shared with another provider and it isn't, and that, you know, actually results in a detrimental effect, I should be going, why was that information not shared, right? When you already have it collected, I've already consented to it being shared. So I think there's a flip side to that. And I think the reason why a lot of people don't get genetic testing is because there's a concern about every other type of health data, is that cyber, you know, breaches of privacy, all those sorts of things. I don't think actually we're thinking a whole lot necessarily about how's it going to affect my insurance. I think it's more about, I don't want someone to get hold of that information. And I've seen too many examples already where stuff that's less sensitive than that is being, you know, accessed.
Question from Jennifer Ng to contribute to the discussion. How do we get over the trust hurdle for people to be willing to share data with insurers?
Is that the same?
Yeah. I have debate with people about whether we're trusted or not trusted as insurers. I actually think people don't know what we are. I don't think it's a matter of trust or distrust. And that is a much bigger problem that we have to get people to know. And then it's actually telling people that we use their information for positive good. I can't help myself but draw sort of comparisons to people who are putting stuff into Instagram, TikTok and Facebook and very happily letting their data, all sorts of data, go everywhere, and yet there is still a resistance. And you know, that can be health data. It's people posting photos of themselves in the hospital with the medical chart, sitting in front of the bed, and they're posting a photo of the food that's terrible, but they're not realizing they've just posted a whole lot of sensitive data. So I take the point, Jennifer. But I think, again, it comes back to demonstrating that we're using it for their benefit. And my point on underwriting is that we're not doing that at all. They see that we're collecting it for our benefit to price them more, not saying we're collecting it, we are using it for this, but here's how it will help you as well.
A comment from Richard Conwell. There needs to be changes to regulations. There are a lot of restrictions on what health insurers and other insurers can do. Life insurers can't do anything that looks like health insurance. Health insurers are restricted from being involved in health management, as doctors want to maintain independence.
Yep, I said earlier on, we don't have the silver bullet. You're absolutely right, Richard. That we and our there are some really good things about our system, and for example, the way community rating is set up and the boundaries between health and life. There are some really bad unintended consequences, like you're pointing out as well. I think that's not a quick game. That's exactly where I go to our point on advocacy, that we have to show that there are things that should change progressively. We have to put the rational arguments for what change could look like and why. But we also do need to think about the products that we're taking to market and how, yeah, we're still selling trauma products that are paying lump sums of hundreds of thousands of dollars for an injury, and where people don't really need hundreds of thousands of dollars because of changing their house or something like that. So we do need to think about making sure that if we're selling products and we're trying to bridge in some way, that we're doing it in a relevant way that's meaningful and not overcharging or over-insuring in some ways. So I think we've got stuff to do as well.
Good question from Ning Ning Wang. How would you convince people to be tracked and convince them that they will or they are having a health problem when they don't believe in it? And on top of that, how would you pay and set a fair and reasonable limit on preventative medicine / treatments?
There you go.
Thanks, Alan. How do we convince people? Look, I mean, I think if you asked everybody in this room, you know, that question, you'd get, what is it? I don't know, 80 answers, maybe more. And I think it probably because it's a personal decision, right? Like, and I think in terms of there's a can answer this question two ways. How do we convince an individual? And then how do you convince a community, you know, to all do the same thing and be tracked? And I think it probably comes back to Alan's point to a large degree, which is what's the benefit to me, right? Like how is that sharing? How is that tracking? How is you using and having access to more information about me and my healthcare going to benefit me and my healthcare? And I think that's the fundamental, you know, kind of question, that I think probably fairly, right? Like we're not doing a good job. Like forget about insurance. Healthcare professionals aren't doing a good job of that. Like, you know, the way that we're bringing data together and or not bringing it together is pretty opaque to the average, you know, consumer. And so we're not doing a good job of saying, what's the benefit of you doing that? And to what extent? And also like, where does the line stop around where actually we don't actually need that much information about you to be able to deliver the best care that we can to you. So I think it comes back to, you know, communication and selling the benefits.
The various players that have from insurance and whether it's life or health tried to play into sort of using wellness apps or capturing data on a Fitbit or an Apple Watch or an Oura Ring or whatever that have tried to do that. They end up with three categories of people. There are people who are already doing it and maybe already have the information, but maybe are still interested in getting more. And so they're probably already doing the right things, but you're getting engagement with them because you're actually helping them a little bit more. And something we in our industries don't do terribly well is engage with consumers. So that's a good thing. There's a bunch of people who probably at that time in life have no interest. You'll never convince them. Don't even try. And then there's this group in the middle who might move. And really the trick would be to get those people moving. But like everything, there are triggers in life that mean you change your thinking. And it might be that you picked up your young child and you got a crick in your back and you went to the physio and the physio said, you've got some problems, you need to work on it. And that's the trigger for you that says, I've been reasonably healthy, I'm now 35 or I'm 25 and whatever, I need to do some more. And that triggers you to move. And can we be positioned to be helping that, whether it's a healthcare provider or whether it's an insurer providing services? It might be the first time you go on to permanent medicine for the rest of your life because there's a condition that's preventable by medicine and you realise you're no longer immortal or no longer invincible, and that's the trigger for you to say, I should manage my health. And so it's not about, I think, forcing people into it. It's saying let's find the right times when people will be open to this and then make sure it's accessible, available and, to Sean's point, useful for them.
Great, thank you. We're out of time. Apologies, we can't get to everyone's question, but surely we will have some time after this session to speak to the presenters if you would like. Please join me in thanking Dr. Sean Chung and Alan Merton.
Okay.